Hey,
you're listening to Avid Research.
Avid Research.
Avid Research.
An Australian STEM podcast.
Where we answer the questions you never quite got around to asking.
My name's Amelia, and today we have yet another awesome guest on the show. We have Dr. Linden, who is a lecturer in climate science and science communication. Welcome to the show, Dr. Linden.
Thanks for having me, Amelia.
It's an absolute pleasure. It sort of feels like they sound like two jobs, but maybe they get along. What is your job?
You're right. It is two jobs. I think I'm the only person in Australia that has my job title, where I get to be a lecturer in climate science and science communication. I feel like I should clarify that that doesn't make me a lecturer in climate science communication. I'm trained as a climate scientist. I'm not trained as a communications expert, but I have qualifications in science communication. So most of my pieces of paper are about atmospheric science and climate science, but I have a postgraduate diploma in science communication. And in my current role at the University of Melbourne, I spend half of my time teaching undergrad students weather and climate science. And then I spend the other half of my time teaching postgrad students largely how to communicate their work more clearly, not just climate scientists and earth scientists, but scientists across the whole faculty, right? From cultural geographers to pure mathematicians to geologists to chemists to bioinformaticians, trying to get these students equipped with the skills and the confidence that they need to communicate their research to a wider audience or to an interdisciplinary audience. I also do a little bit of research. I also do a little bit of outreach. I also do all these different kinds of things that make up an academic job. So my job is lots of different jobs, but I think I'm at the stage of my career where I can be honest with myself and say that is the way I like it.
Which is always an awesome place to find someone happy in the thing that they're doing.
Yeah, it's nice.
For some reason, the first question that's coming up for me is, might be a bit spicy, and feel free. Ooh. Do you find any particular disciplines of students find it more challenging to communicate their research easily?
Oh, that is a really great question. And we do find, so we teach a few subjects, right? I'm part of the University of Melbourne Science Communication Teaching Program. We're a team of five people from different backgrounds, from ecology, astrophysics, immunology, exercise science, and then there's me. And so we teach students, undergrads and postgrads, across a broad range of fields. And I find the pure mathematicians and theoretical physicists can sometimes find it really tricky, right? If you put people in a room and somebody's studying a genetic treatment for cancer and somebody's studying how to look after an endangered species and then someone else is studying a different way to examine a statistical problem, trying to convince each other of the value of all of those pieces of research can be tricky, right? And I feel like people who are doing blue sky research or theoretical research can sometimes have a harder time communicating their work. But I've worked really hard with those students, and I care very deeply about those students knowing that it's not about saying, oh, we can address climate change with my research. It's about showing the passion of your work. And, you know, I was talking to a student just yesterday who does pure maths, and I said, but why are you doing what you're doing? And he told me this big long story about this theory that had been around for a long time, and they don't know if they're ever going to solve it in maths. And he, you know, I got the sense that he just was excited to be a part of that, a little piece of that history. And those stories are super engaging, but it can be trickier to get that across to students and to get them really excited in that way. So we find some students who do blue sky or theoretical research quite really hate our subject, and some of them really, really like it. So yeah, the other field is probably more social sciences, some social science groups where the methodologies are very different to lab-based research.
Yes.
Getting that cross-disciplinary communication can be really tricky too, I find.
Yes, I can see them not always getting along, and could get a little spicy.
Yes, it does get a little spicy, but I think that's the whole point, right? Like, when else in your studies or in your career do you get a chance to be in a room with people that study just so many different things? so things that are so different to what you're exploring. Everybody's intelligent, everybody is passionate about what they do, and you get an opportunity to share what you're doing and talk about your work. This is just one aspect of the things that we teach in our program. We also teach people who want to learn how to communicate science more broadly, not necessarily their own science. And we teach people who are going out into the workplace but might not feel that they have the skills to communicate successfully at a job. And so we teach things about email etiquette and cultural differences and working as a team, all those skills that are so valuable and so employable and so transferable. But often when it comes to doing a science degree or even a science master's, it's just expected that you're going to know or that you're going to pick it up. And we kind of, yeah, we
magically, you'll pick it up.
Exactly. And we kind of call bullshit on that a little bit, because that's not really how you're going to develop those skills. If you don't have a good mentor, if you don't have a good supervisor who can help you with those, then you're really in a bit of strife. So we take this opportunity to embed those skills within the program, like within the master's or the undergraduate Bachelor of Science that you're doing. So when you finish, you know that you've got that training. And, you know, it's not like going to a lot of lectures to learn about how to do those things. We have lots and lots of practices and lots of exercises to get people building up those confidence, building up that confidence in those skills. So yeah, they can make a difference, really. That's what we're about. And that's why I love the science communication component of what I do.
Because, you know, science has obviously value in getting done, but making sure other people know about it and can act on it and then build on it is invaluable.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, you can do the best research in the world, but if nobody knows about it, is it making a difference?
Yeah.
You know, and this, I'm not talking about making sure that every person on the street knows about your research. It's about figuring out who your audience is and who you need to tell, right? And that's part of the communication skills development too, right? I'm not talking about, yeah, making everybody a extroverted science communicator that wants to go and, you know, wear colorful shirts and do a bunch of shows or anything like that. If that's what you want to do, awesome. We'd love to support you to do that. But it's more about enabling you to have the skills for writing and speaking and working with different people so that you can talk to other people in your lab or somebody at a conference or someone slightly outside your discipline with whom you could collaborate to make that next big step or to address that next big problem. Because that's how the biggest problems in the world are going to get solved, not by people hanging out on their own, but by people working together, working across disciplines and across barriers, across languages, across types of jargon, across types of labs, across lots of different things. We need everybody to work together.
Often when we think about science communication, we're thinking purely scientists to general public and not so much scientists to peers in different fields. How does that type of communication like vary? What are the sort of differences between communicating between scientists and then communicating outside into, I don't know, normal people. the general population.
Yeah. I mean, in some ways there's not much difference because you've got to think about who you're talking to, respect their time, respect their intelligence, think about what's going to resonate with them, why they should listen to you, why they should read what you have written, or why they should care about what you have to say. So in some respects, it's very similar. But to me, I think the biggest difference is that you don't have to convince somebody else within science that science is of value, right? Mm-hmm. That would be the biggest difference to me. You don't have to justify doing research because you're talking to someone else who is also doing research or working in the scientific space. You already have that level of agreement together. Whereas if you were talking to someone on the street who hadn't done science since year nine, went on to have a successful career as an economist or as a teacher or as a football coach or something else, you've got to go all the way back to, okay, remember in year nine when you did this, now let me bring you up to the where I am. You know, that can be a different conversation to have.
So
do you agree? I don't know.
Maybe I think not. That makes sense. Like, similar problems in that you're going to be facing, like jargon is going to be a problem in either space, but
yeah, absolutely,
they're on different baselines.
Yeah, and maybe the interest level is different. Like if you can, okay, so say I was talking to an epigeneticist. I haven't done biology since year nine, right? So in that way, I am fairly similar to the football coach who you meet at the supermarket. But I can understand the scientific process, right? I understand their need to collect enough evidence to make a statement of finding. I can understand their approach to kind of working rigorously, to exploring the literature, to understanding where they sit in context, maybe a little bit differently to somebody who hasn't worked in that research space before. I guess that would be it. Yeah, you don't have to convince somebody that your way of doing anything is valid. Maybe?
I think that makes sense. Like you're with some different like approaches aside, the general tools will be the same.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think so. Like the fundamentals of all communication, right? Mm. Think about why you're doing it and think about who you're doing it with, not to. Like you say, lots of science communication is the scientist to lots of people, but that one-to-many approach has been shown again and again and again to not be a useful way to get a message across or to make change, but no matter who you're talking with, thinking about why you're talking with them and, yeah, what your goal is and who you're talking to, basically.
Yeah. And what the thing is that they will be able to latch on and resonate with.
Yeah.
Like, what can they connect with?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's the other thing to think about. If you say, oh, well, you're a scientist, you're in a room full of other scientists, maybe you think, oh, thank goodness, I don't have to worry about trying to engage these people. They're automatically going to be fascinated by what I'm saying. But we know that's not the case, right? Even if you're in a room full of people who are all experts in the same field as you, you still want to capture their attention with something interesting or something engaging. You still want to tell the story of your research in a useful way. You just throw a bunch of facts at them or give them a bunch of complicated statistics. Like, the smartest professor is still going to glaze over more than if you are actually able to engage them. And so that's kind of what we try to get across as well.
An interesting challenge, your job for
sure. But an exciting challenge, and one that I really care a lot about. You know, before I started this role, I was at the Bureau of Meteorology for a couple of years doing climate research, climate operations, so preparing the monthly statements about how hot or cold or wet or dry it had been across the country. But I took this role at the University of Melbourne because I really felt that equipping the next generation of scientists with these skills would just be able to allow them to make a big impact, right? I thought, I can do that again. Before I started at the University of Melbourne, I was at the Bureau of Meteorology and I worked there for a couple of years doing research and collecting statistics about how hot or dry, wet or cold it was across the country, those kinds of things. But one of the reasons I moved to Melbourne Uni was because I feel really strongly that the best people to communicate about their research are the researchers themselves. And I think if we can equip the next generation of scientists with the skills to talk about their work and in an engaging and meaningful way, then that's a really powerful tool to make change and to make impact in the world. And yeah, this is my little attempt to make a difference, I suppose.
It's fantastic. I have absolutely no doubt that you are. And
I'm having fun.
That's always a good, solid start. So you did explicitly say that you weren't lecturing in, the overlap of communication of climate science. I have seen out there like specific courses for that exact topic, because obviously it's quite a multi-dimensional topic within science communication. How do you find the interaction between the two?
I suppose when I say like I'm not a climate science communication expert, I do dabble in talking about that a little bit. I do some guest lectures and I do, you know, help some students in that space because I know a little bit about both, right? And there is I think my Venn diagram circles are kind of getting closer to and closer as my career progresses, and I would like to work more in that climate change communication research area. But my research so far is more on the climate change side. I feel like climate change communication can be tricky. I feel like climate change communication can be trickier than some other kind of science communication. Now, there are some people who disagree with me. I've heard a few people say, oh, what? Climate science is just the same as any other science. Like, it just needs clear communication.
I feel like they possibly haven't seen some social media comments.
Well, I mean, this is the thing. Like, I wish that I could agree with those people, but I don't. I just think that climate change science and climate science communication is more politicized and has a lot more baggage than if you were talking about space, for example, or if you were talking about the discovery of a new species, or if you were talking about cancer treatment or those kinds of things. You know, there are some stories that people are going to naturally gravitate towards because it relates to them directly. Drink more red wine or less red wine, eat more chocolate or less chocolate, and it will do good things or bad things to you. There are other topics that people naturally gravitate towards because they're like, ooh, amazing, like exciting science stories about black holes or various other, you know, things like that. But climate science is complicated. It feels far away in space and time. It's bloody depressing most of the time. And it's got a lot more politics around it than lots of other areas of science, I believe. And it's been in the media for a long, long time, right? To deal with the information that climate scientists are telling us requires changes in our behaviour, requires us to face up to some scary facts and some scary potential futures. And so it's really easy when you're talking about climate science. I do it myself. I don't know about you. I don't always read the climate science news that I see because I know what it's going to say and it's going to bum me out. And, you know, the last few years in particular, people have had a lot of negative news and a lot of scary things, and we have to look after ourselves, right? So when I teach climate change communication now, I talk about those difficulties, and I talk about, again, coming back to those ideas of knowing why you're communicating and who you're communicating to, what your message is, trying to figure out if you're the best messenger for that particular message, or if there's somebody else that you can talk to who can then talk to the audience that you're trying to influence. And then also looking after yourself, because climate change is a marathon, not a sprint. It's not going away in any of our lifetimes. And if this is an area that you are going to be a part of, and if it's a topic that you care about, then you have to make sure that you've got the stamina to front up every day and do the little bit that you can do, right? So playing to your strengths, finding activities that nourish you as well as allow you to feel that you're making a difference. All of those different kinds of things when it comes to climate change communicating, I think, are really important, particularly for students, right, as they're trying to figure out what to do next and how their futures are going to look and what their careers are going to look like, trying to figure out, allow them to figure out where they can play a role and what they can do that will give them sustenance and give them hope and also allow them to make impact. So that's kind of where I sit at the moment in terms of talking about climate change communication. My area of research is also more about the past climate than the present and the future, which lends me to do climate change communication in a different kind of way, or in a way that is more of interest to some audiences than others, which informs the way that I do my own communication about my research, if that makes sense.
I think so. Finding that sustainability is so hard. Like, you definitely watch people burn out, and whether it's like get overexposed to the bads.
Yeah, absolutely. It's so easy to do. And, you know, I think a lot of people, when they think, why aren't people doing more about climate change? Why isn't there more action? We need to talk to that 9 or 10% of the population who don't accept the science of climate change, right? Poll after poll after poll stubbornly shows that there is this sort of minority of the Australian population that refuses to accept the science of of climate change. And this has been repeatedly linked to ideological beliefs more than scientific understanding, right? These people are intelligent, they care about things, they're probably reasonable in lots of different ways, but when it comes to this particular topic, accepting the idea that humans are having an impact on the globe, it just doesn't align with their values or their belief system, right? Mm. And there is no amount of science communication that is going to change the minds of these people. And there's not much that can be done about that, right? But there is a lot of energy that can be wasted by trying.
Yes, yes. You can run really hard into that brick wall over and over.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And I've got people I really look up to who say, okay, well, don't worry about communicating to those people. Have the conversations anyway, and then know that other people are also watching. Like if you're having an argument with somebody on Twitter who won't accept the science of climate change, don't think about that person. You're never actually going to change their mind. Think about all the people who are reading the tweets, right? Maybe you'll change their minds, or maybe you'll influence them somehow. And that's an individual decision for people to make. But for me, I'm like, oh, I'm not strong enough to manage that. I don't think I could have those conversations without just wanting to crawl into a hole, really, because that would be so brutal on me. But other people, that does sort of charge them, and they enjoy going in to have those debates and to have those discussions, and also to learn about how different people think. Because another aspect of communication, of climate change communication, that can be problematic is to divide people into this us versus them kind of, the people who won't accept the science of climate change and the people who are trying to do good, like the goodies and baddies. It's a helpful narrative in some way, and it's really motivating for some people, but in terms of actually having constructive conversations, it doesn't really work that well. And so trying to find common ground can be more useful than going in for a big fight, which means that, yeah, you've got to pick your battles, I suppose, and think about what's sustainable to you. And whether you do that in a community and find community organisations that allow you to work in a team, or whether you pick your methods that are the most appropriate to you, or pick your platforms. I don't know, just have as many conversations as you can to learn things and to share things and to support each other. I don't know. There's so many different things you can do, but they all take energy, and we all have limited amounts of energy. So it's about finding what works best for you. And that happens through trial and error too. Trying something out and then thinking, oh no, that's not for me. And then trying something else. And sharing that too. I really like the idea of sharing.
That's cool.
What people are trying and what people aren't trying. You know, climate change is everywhere. It should be in most of our conversations about what we're trying to do to live sustainably and try to make impact. And I don't know. I don't see it chatted about at as many barbecues as maybe it could be. And that would be a small but manageable way to have an impact.
That's a nice thought, isn't it? Like, if we could get to the point where kind of the sting could get taken out of it a little bit, and it could just be a little bit more chiller, like
just like a standard part of the conversation. Oh, did you see that sport event on the weekend? Oh, how's this weather we're having? Oh, how's your meat-free food schedule going? You know, just the casual steps along the way to normalize the fact that we're living with this problem, and we all have to figure out what we can do at an individual level, a family level, a community level. I don't know. Sharing is, as my daughter says somewhat aggressively, sharing is caring. And if you're sharing what you're doing, then that sort of shows that you care.
Well, that's fantastic. So is your research in for your climate research?
Yeah, so my research is about historical climatology. I'm a historical climatologist by training. There's not that many of us in Australia. There's probably only two, actually. There's not that many people, but there are a lot of people in the Northern Hemisphere who would consider themselves historical climatologists. So I kind of work in that space after European invasion, but before the formation of the Bureau of Meteorology in 1908. So my area of expertise is 19th century weather and climate variability. I study that by looking at old books and old archives, old weather observations, newspaper reports, letters, journals, those kinds of things, pulling all that information together to see what we can understand about the weather and the climate before the signal of human-induced climate change started to rear its ugly head, basically. So my PhD was about extending the climate record for southeastern Australia back to 1788, adding another 120 or so years to the climate record that we use to understand what goes on with our temperature and our rainfall and our air pressure. And so that was kind of the first pass of finding all these old records and seeing what they had to tell us and understanding kind of what they meant, how much we could rely on them. Some were quite good, some were quite dodgy. You can't just pick up these numbers that are 150 years old and then say, oh, great, well, that must be the truth. Like, you have to really dig deep and understand who took those weather observations, how did they take them, why did they take them, you know, if they were trying to take them. I actually haven't found many examples of this in Australia, but I think it's been seen in other places. If you could show that your rainfall was quite low, then maybe that would increase your chance of getting support or those kinds of things. Like, you really have to be a skeptical, critical thinker. You can't just trust the numbers. You've got to use lots of different sources and pull all those things together, which means I needed to use some detective skills and statistical analysis and lots of different comparisons to pull everything together and determine, yeah, what the climate looked like back to 1788. That also involves comparing numbers with paleoclimate information too, so natural reconstructions of temperature and rainfall using tree rings and ice cores, coral skeletons, those kinds of things. And now I continue to work in that space, but more. So back then I was looking at the climate, like how is year to year, decade to decade kind of changing. But now I'm trying to see if we can use these really old records to look at extreme weather events and extreme climate events like floods or heat waves and that kind of stuff. Because understanding what they looked like in the past and how they're changing, you know, is really, really helpful. Not only is it helpful for getting us to appreciate what could happen in the future, right, if we've got a longer record of what was going on in the past, but I find they're a really useful communication tool as well. Like, some people say, oh, there were heat waves in the 1800s in Australia, well, therefore climate change can't be real. Mm-hmm. And sadly, that's not the case. But we can say, look, heat waves have been a part of the Australian weather and climate system for a long time. Mm-hmm. Look at how much more supercharged they are now that Australia is nearly 1.5 degrees warmer than it was 120 years ago. So it's connecting, continuing to come back to this idea of connecting science and stories, you know, the people behind the numbers. I'm really interested in untangling that and sort of making sure that's part of the conversation. The weather records around the world, the basis of every single study of weather and climate around the whole planet, right? So many papers are published using data sets that have been put together by people like me using all these different sources of information to get it together in essentially a complicated Excel spreadsheet that people then, scientists then go off and use. But if the original data hasn't been assessed for quality and hasn't been assessed for trustworthiness, then you're kind of building everything on something that isn't solid. So I want to make sure that it's solid, if that makes sense.
I think that makes a huge amount of sense. It sounds fascinating.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I love it. It's so interesting. It's so exciting. And it's, yeah, it's such an important component, right? It's like step one before you go off and do all your other kinds of things. And I really like exploring. I often think, like, I wanted to be a meteorologist for a really long time. And I often think if climate change wasn't around, I'd still be doing this job, because understanding how our weather patterns work and understanding, you know, extreme hot or cold or crazy snow events and all those kinds of things, like, they're so interesting, even without, like, the background temperature warming that's making everything behave in a crazy, crazy way that hasn't been seen at any other time since humans have been alive. And so I really enjoy the opportunity to get to know how our weather works, but also the people behind who recorded the weather. It's really interesting. I mean, of course I'm going to say that, but I think it is really interesting and people like hearing about it.
Do you have any particularly favorite stories about, like, people who did the collecting?
Yeah, yeah.
Because I feel like there were some odd eggs back then. And
yeah, now. There were some odd eggs. And, I mean, the vast majority of them were men, right? So a lot of weather observations taken in Australia or taken around the world, really, in the 19th century, were taken by men, scientific men who were kind of trained in a bunch of different sciences. A lot of the early white explorers considered taking weather observations just as part of the exploration job. You've got to understand the plants and the animals and the geography and the geology and the weather, you know, so they would travel with big weather equipment, travel with big weather instruments and take observations. So a lot of our early white explorer documents have got weather observations in them, which is cool. So I've got so many. I know there's so many interesting stories. I've worked really closely with a family in northern New South Wales for a long time. I've been working with them for over 10 years to rescue the weather observations of their grandfather out near Armidale. His name was Algernon Belfield and he was a cattle
grazer. That's an amazing name.
It's such a great name. The Belfields have been residents in the Armidale region for a long time. And Algernon took weather observations for about 40 years. Every day at 9 a.m., he'd go out and he'd take weather observations from like 1877 to shortly before he passed away in 1922. And it's been so rewarding to work with the Belfield family and the archives in Armidale and also the University of New England, this kind of collection of people, largely retirees, and get those data from a piece of paper into a spreadsheet, into a global database that now improves the understanding of past weather and climate in Australia and therefore around the Southern Hemisphere as well. I said that there's not many historical climatologists in Australia, but there are a lot more in the Northern Hemisphere because, of course, there's more land in the Northern Hemisphere and the written history is a lot longer up there. And so that means if you look at a map of the past and kind of put a dot where all the weather stations are or where the historical weather records come from, there are a lot more dots in the Northern Hemisphere than the Southern Hemisphere. Mm-hmm. And that means that every new dot we can add just is so valuable, right? Every new discovery that we find, every old book that we uncover, not only improves our understanding of Australia, but also lights up the whole Southern Hemisphere. They're really powerful from a hemispherical and a global point of view. So it's been really exciting to work with the Belfields and say, okay, Algernon's record is now in the US and now it's contributing to this and now it's contributing to that. So that's really fun. I also really like reading about the extreme events that happen, you know, so there have been some really big downpours that I found in Sydney in the 1840s. There was a big one in 1841 and there was a big one in 1844. And these events always come with really flowery newspaper descriptions, right? So if you go to the newspapers at the time, which fortunately a lot of them have been digitized by the National Library of Australia, you can read about all the impacts of these torrential downpours and all those kinds of things. And it's fun to kind of cross-reference the numbers with the words. I remember in the 1844 downpour, there was a quote from a resident who said, "Oh my goodness, I've never seen anything like this. Oh my God, it was so much rain." But the numbers suggest that just a few years earlier, like actually there was a heavier rainfall event. And I really like kind of teasing out just the people behind all of those things. And yeah, one other thing I also really enjoy is that this kind of work, like I can't sit here and type up the values all by myself. It would take me, you know, 50 lifetimes and I, you know, only have half of one pretty much. So we work with a lot of citizen scientists or we work with a lot of community groups who help us uncover the records, scan the records and then transcribe those observations too. And that can be really exciting for us and for them to uncover, oh, look, I found an interesting event here. Oh, there was mention of a meteor in this diary or, you know, I found records that talk about my grandfather on this ship while I was transcribing the weather observations. All these kinds of fascinating stories that get uncovered. It's really rewarding.
I think it also just shows how human science is, but also like how fundamental the weather is.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, definitely. Definitely. And I suppose that's a good thing, right? There's always going to be newspaper articles about the weather that you can use when it comes to checking the numbers against the words and those kinds of things. And in terms of what invasion in Australia and weather and climate history, the timing, like the Enlightenment age and colonization happened at a similar time. So the ideas about how to record the weather and thinking about the importance of having lots of different weather observations around the place so you could understand how weather systems worked, or so you could minimize deaths at sea because of big storms and those kinds of things, were all happening at a similar time. So that's why in many ways we do have weather records that go back all the way to 1788. Yeah. And I mean, I need to acknowledge as well that I'm talking about, in the history of Australia, such a tiny slice, right? Such a tiny slice of weather and climate information, because Indigenous knowledge and Indigenous science has so much more to tell us about the past of our weather and climate. But this particular aspect, I suppose, is lazy, I guess, because it lends itself more easily to be graphed and to be shared and be correlated with modern observations, right? It's much more Western science friendly, I suppose, but it's not by any means the most valuable way to explore the climate of the past.
And it's good for a little bit of baseline, but there was some before invasion as well.
Yes, so. Absolutely. Yeah, and I think even since I have started my career, I've seen a greater appreciation in Western science of Indigenous history and Indigenous knowledge, understanding past climate variability, past geological variations and events, biological evolution, you know, plant migrations, all sorts of different things. I hope to see more of that in the future. We need more of that in the future if we're going to avoid the worst of the climate crisis.
Find some kind of balance, maybe.
Yes, that would be good.
How did you arrive at this point in your career? Like, what did you want to be when you were in high school, and then what was the pathway from there to here?
I remember when I was in, I knew you were going to ask me this question. I wanted to think of something pithy to say, but I just didn't get there. I remember, though, hearing some advice before I started my PhD from somebody when they were asked, oh, how did you get to this point in your career? And the person said, what? I don't have a career. I've just done stuff that sounded fun. And now here I am. And I have hung on to that for a really long time. And now I think, actually, yeah, that's what I've done. I've just done stuff that was fun. And now here I am. I have always been interested in the weather. I grew up in country Victoria, about 2 hours north of Melbourne, on the lands of the Yorta Yorta people, in a little town called Tatura. And I remember the big sky and listening to the thunderstorms at night off in the distance. You know, I remember flooding events of the 90s and the big millennium drought of the late 1990s, early 2000s. You know, the weather had a big impact. I still argue to this day that the weather affects every single aspect of our lives, from how we feel to where we holiday to how we dress to what we eat to so many aspects of our lives. And so I was really interested in meteorology, and I had been for a long time, apart from a brief stage in primary school when I wanted to be a secretary and a poet. I always sort of knew that meteorology was what I was interested in. So I went to uni and I did maths and physics and meteorology, but I got quickly overwhelmed by the maths and physics only. I felt like that was really, I struggled with that. I found it a little bit too dry and overwhelming for me. So then I did an English diploma as well. Very privileged to be able to take an extra year of university to add some English to my science degree. And about halfway through my undergraduate, I saw a talk from somebody who was working in the science communication space. They had worked as a climate scientist, but had then moved over to communication. They worked for CSIRO. And I'm sure you've heard this story from many people who find their way into science communication. They think, what? That's a thing? You can be involved in science and talk about it? That's amazing. I want to do that. And so that was a really pivotal moment for me, and I changed my life a little bit. I went on, I finished my undergrad, I did an honours year, I did some research, and then I went to Canberra and I did the graduate diploma in science communication up there, which at that time involved being part of the Questacon Science Circus, which is... It ran for a long time, and it was the birthplace of many well-known science communicators in Australia, Lee Constable, Nate Byrne, lots of different people have been through the circus program. It was an incredible opportunity to travel Australia with wonderful people who knew lots about different types of science and make slime and blow fireballs at kids and, yeah, going around to regional and remote schools across the country talking about science and sharing science with lots of students who otherwise might not get to see it. So that was super-duper fun, but didn't make me overly employable because I had collected all of these pieces of paper, but I hadn't actually done any work. I'd just been to uni for a really long time. So I came back to Melbourne and couldn't really get a job. I ended up selling broadband internet plans over the phone for, oh, I can't even remember the hourly rate, but it wasn't very high. And so when a PhD opportunity came up and it sounded really interesting and it combined my love of kind of English and stories with maths and atmospheric science, and the pay was better than what I was getting paid at the time, I thought, yeah, righto, that sounds awesome. I want to do that. And so I went and did a PhD because it sounded fun. And it was. It was really interesting to, yeah, delve deep. It's such a rare opportunity to dive deeply into a topic and really get to know something. You don't get many chances in your life to do that. Like, it's PhD is hard, but it's hard because it's a slog, not because I was particularly intelligent or anything. You just kind of had to be stubborn and keep putting one foot in front of the other until it was done. And so I managed to keep doing that. And then I worked in the non-for-profit sector for a year, managing a citizen science project where people would take weather observations. Oh, no, sorry. People would take observations of plants and animal behavior, and that would be collected to help understand changes in the climate. It's called Climate Watch. It's still running. If you're interested, you can download it on your phone and document when a magpie swoops you or when you see the jacaranda flowering and all those kinds of things. It's a really useful data set. It's been running for a long time now. And that was a short-term contract, though, because non-for-profit organizations don't often have a lot of funding. But then a postdoc opportunity came up in Spain. So my partner and I ducked off to Spain for a couple of years, and that was really fun. It was probably not the smartest career move. I left my network behind. I went to a place where the weather and climate was quite different. All the weather systems rotated in the other direction. And, you know, the universe mall wasn't as connected as what I was kind of used to in Australia. So it maybe wasn't the best career move, but it was a really, really fun thing to do. And then we came back after a couple of years and I moved to the Bureau and now I'm here. So I can't remember what your question was, but that's me. That's my career journey in a nutshell.
Well, you actually just answered the whole question. So,
oh, there you go. Yeah, that's how I got to where I got to, collecting these things along the way. And I think all of the jobs that I've done have enabled me to try out communicating with different audiences, right? Mm-hmm. I've made lots of mistakes. I have failed at lots of different things. I've made lots of errors. But after each one, I've kind of thought, okay, well, that didn't work for that reason. And this isn't working for this reason. And this isn't giving me what I want because I actually want this, you know. So by the time it came to this job where I am now, I finally had enough confidence and enough experience and enough self-awareness to say, actually, what's going to work for me is if I can do a little bit of this and a little bit of that and a little bit of this, is that okay? And the university was kind enough to say, yeah, all right, you can do that. And so I do, which maybe is not the best for work-life balance, but I'm just going to keep doing it until someone tells me I can't. I hope nobody senior from uni Mel was listening to this.
I honestly feel like that's how most academics function, yeah. On the like us rather than permission approach. You obviously are balancing a lot of different things simultaneously at the moment, though. And before we started recording, you mentioned that part of your like life experiment this year is actually documenting where your time goes. I feel like that's something that a lot of us know that like we kind of should do because we think our time's just kind of leaking somewhere, but we don't really know why or where it is. How you like actually successfully documented your time?
This is a thing that I've been trying to figure out for ages, right? So I work part-time. I've got two young kids. And when I came back to work part-time. I looked at a lot of my colleagues, people I really respect who do incredible work, and they were also working part-time on paper, but every single one of them, 100% of them said to me, oh, no, but I work full-time, right? And I thought, how am I going to do this? I physically cannot work full-time. I don't get enough sleep as it is. I need to figure out how my time is going, and so I can look at the data and say, right, well, I'm supposed to be working this much, but I'm actually working this much. Where is it going and what am I doing? And because my job has so many components too, I really wanted some accountability. So when my boss or my bosses, because I have several jobs, say to me, oh, okay, so are you doing the fraction that you're supposed to be doing for me? And are you doing the fraction that you're supposed to be doing for them? I could say yes, or actually not really. And so, yeah, I've been using, I can tell you about the tool if you want. I'm just using Toggle, which is a free like time management thing, a tool. I think people use it. You can get a subscription if you're a big company and you want to track everybody's time and billable hours and that kind of stuff. But I just do it for me. They haven't asked for money from me yet, where I just document what I'm doing. I've tried to split everything up into different projects, whether I'm working on one subject or another subject. I kind of have my clients as my research or different teaching roles or different leadership roles that I have or media and communication activities that I do. I kind of color code them so I can see. And the website's really great because it allows you to look over the week and say, oh, right, well, you spent 50% of your time doing that and 60% of your time doing that. It's quite iterative. So as I said before, I made quite a few mistakes when I started doing this. I had too many different categories and sections. And so when it came to analyzing the data, it was just too messy. So now I'm trying to make it a little bit more streamlined so I can easily say, oh, wow, I spent 8 hours on email in the last 4 days. That doesn't seem like the funnest use of my time. Let's see if we can focus that up. Or, you know, right, you're spending this many hours a week on meetings. Do you have to do that? Is there something else that you can do? I haven't actually figured out what to do with the data in terms of improving my own practice or my own work flow, but it's useful for me to have a snapshot at the end of the week and also see it graphically. You know, if I look at it and go, oh, you've worked every night for the past week, maybe that's why you're so tired. Or, you know, you feel like you're working for 8 hours, but actually you're only working for six because of whatever reason, then I can make some plans about that. So actually talking about it out loud is really helpful. I might go and explore the data straight after this, but it's been helpful for me and surprisingly easy to do. Stop and start, just in my browser as I go working away. You can also use the app on your phone. I feel like I should be sponsored by them, but I'm not. I just find the process really easy. Toggle, T-O-G-G-L. There's lots of other ones you can use, but that one's worked for me.
I think it's an interesting concept, particularly as everything gets pushed.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And also, you know, it's been helpful for me too if I've got a project that I'm just not progressing on, like a manuscript. Maybe lots of people have that situation. For me to have a specific color for that. So at the end of the week, I can go, oh, yep, there are the blue ones. I managed to squeeze in an hour on that paper. That kind of encourages me, I suppose.
That's awesome. I'm really curious where you'll land.
Yeah, maybe I'll write something about it, or maybe I'll be a bit too embarrassed. Say, oh no, I've spent the equivalent of 4 months on email and my inbox is still a disaster. I'm not sure. I haven't figured it out yet.
I wish you could give to younger Lyndon.
It's okay if you don't quite fit. I think I feel as though it took me a long time to accept that I was never going to be the big high-flying scientist who had all the papers, or the big high-flying communicator that it was on all the TV shows. But I was able to be somewhere in the middle, and that still had value and that still had influence, I suppose. So I suppose back yourself and don't worry quite so much would be advice that I often give to younger students now as well. People get really stressed about assignments or small assessment tasks, and it's good to be passionate and it's good to care about what you're doing, but also ultimately it's a small assessment task in one subject in one semester of one thing. just give something a go. And if it doesn't work, you can learn for next time. I think it's hard not to fear failure. It's easy to be afraid of failing. And I wish that I had been a bit braver about that when I was younger.
I feel like that's a bit of a tricky one, though, because you need to fail to build up the bravery about the failing.
Yeah, true. Like, that's true. Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Definitely. So maybe younger me wouldn't take that advice. And if I was to give that advice to younger me, she'd probably ignore it. Being brave can only serve you. If you are brave and you fail, then you've learnt something, right? And it's hard to be brave when you're younger, but I wish I had been a bit braver, I suppose. I guess that would be my advice. Don't be afraid to try and be a bit brave.
That's really lovely. I asked this question. Do you have any particular myths that, and I'm thinking about historical Australian weather patterns specifically, but that you'd like to take this opportunity to bust?
Ooh. One big myth that gets a lot of attention every summer when we have a heat wave in Australia is that there was a heat wave back in the 1900s that was way hotter than this, right? There are a few weather observations dotted around the place that show really high temperatures in the late 1800s. There's a few different heat waves in New South Wales and sort of the central part of Australia. And these get pulled out every year by people who say, look, it was hotter back then, therefore climate change isn't real. Like, that is a very loud myth that someone like me is uniquely qualified to bust, because those observations were not taken in a standard way, comparing these really high temperatures that were taken when a thermometer was in a box or a thermometer. We've got records of thermometers being in beer crates, thermometers being housed in all sorts of weird spaces. It means that you can't compare those weather records to the weather records that were taken today, right? You have to use really, you have to use really detailed statistical analysis to kind of figure out how accurate and how reliable those observations are. So the myth that I'm trying to bust is that climate change isn't real because there were heat waves in the past. There were heat waves in the past, but the ones that we're having now are hotter, more frequent, and more intense, and they will continue to be so as long as we continue to heat the planet. That's a pretty depressing myth to bust, but it is, that's the truth.
It is. It is. And that's sometimes, not all myths are happy. Well, I mean, you can see with, no, they have some very, yeah, we take people's word. And in this case, like, the thermometer is the equivalent of someone's word, very, like, it's gold.
Yeah, and it's also kind of bad science either to say, oh, there's one weather observation in Bourke in 1896 that was quite warm, therefore all of the thousands of trends that we see all around the world in lots and lots of different variables, whether it's ice or temperature or sea level or any kind of climate-related variable you choose, all those trends are going up or down in the case of cold things. It's a pretty big jump to say this one value in a regional part of Australia therefore means that all those graphs are a lie. Like, that's a fairly... it's a common trope that's used in lots of conversations, but it's not good science and it doesn't really stand up to much analysis, but it keeps being used.
Yeah. A good story, I guess.
Mm. Yeah, it is a good story, yeah. Yep.
To wrap up, do you have a shout out for us, a virtual high five, someone who thinks doing an awesome job and deserves some kudos?
Oh, goodness. I know so many people who are doing great jobs. I'll do a quick shout out to Dr. Lily O'Neill, who is running the Climate Kids program at Melbourne Climate Futures. She is a climate lawyer and she's put together these awesome videos. I'm involved in them as well. These awesome videos where kids are asking questions about climate and climate change and climate science, and she's trying to answer them with the help of experts across Melbourne Uni. So big shout out to her. And if you have children who are getting worried about this stuff, then maybe Climate Kids could be for you. Also, Lee Constable's doing really great work in the climate communication space, talking about the future of energy, and her latest book about how to save the whole blinking planet is really full of empowering ideas for kids and parents alike. All of my students are doing great work. I don't know, I could shout out lots of people, but I'll highlight those two and look forward to hearing some other shout outs from others maybe when this goes to air.
Awesome. Thank you so much for coming on the show, Dr. Linden. It has been absolutely delightful and full of fun facts and just fascinating things. So keep up the awesome work.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
No worries. Thanks for tuning in. If you like this episode, please pass it on to someone else who you think might enjoy it as well. And if you want to support Avid Research this year, that would be amazing. You can buy us a coffee. Head to avidresearch.com.au and there'll be a link, buy me a coffee, and you can support us with a one-off little coffee payment. Thanks so much for listening. You're a legend.